I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I lay down my life in order to take it up again. In God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer. Amen. The fourth Sunday after Easter is generally Good Shepherd Sunday. And we think of the Good Shepherd in all of the stained glass windows and pictures of Jesus lovingly carrying the sheep and finding the lost sheep and bringing it home. But this Lent and Eastertide, I've been thinking about the Good Shepherd and the many roles the Good Shepherd plays. The Good Shepherd is comforter, but also the Good Shepherd gives up his life for the sheep, protects the sheep at all cost. The Good Shepherd knows each of us needs. And this Good Shepherd we find in the post-resurrection time, a Good Shepherd who has already hung on the cross, who's been at the table, but at the cross and out of the empty tomb. So about a week ago, I made a drive I've made many times before, a drive south, down 95 to Richmond, Virginia. And at Petersburg, I veer to the right and make a trip that I've been making since I was 18 years old, going south down I-85, the way I went to Davidson College, the way I went to my in-laws in Decatur, Georgia, and the way that I went to my son Jack's graduation from college at Emory in Atlanta this past Monday. As you go down I-85, for those who have made that trip, along the roadway you pass a number of crosses, scenes of Calvary, of Good Friday. In Spartanburg, South Carolina, there is a large red cross that I passed twice last week that at night lights up. And a red glow appears for miles around when you travel at night. But as I drove further and further south, I began to see three crosses on a hill near the highway, in a churchyard, by the side of the road. Part of the resurrection narratives talk to us about sharing the suffering of Christ, even as we celebrate his resurrection. The letter from 1 Peter talks about enduring pain while suffering unjustly or following the way of the cross. So what's the view like from those crosses? On Good Friday, when we contemplate this, it's easier to see ourselves at the foot of the cross than on one of those crosses next to Jesus looking down at the crowd. And what might we see from the cross? Do we see paradise? I don't think so. We see a world in a whole lot of trouble, with wars and violence and injustice and poverty. If we take our place on the cross of the criminal, we are right next to Jesus. And unlike at the Last Supper, when we can recline next to him, perhaps be comforted at the closeness of his presence, when we are on the cross with him, we see all that Jesus sees. We are confronted with all that Jesus sees. I'd like you to imagine the Good Shepherd, the post-resurrection Good Shepherd, as someone who continues that work of the cross, as well as the comforting work and joy of the resurrection. Scholar N.T. Wright says that looking down from the cross of Jesus, we have to face the most searching questions we avoid like the plague, because we too find it desperately uncomfortable to look on God's creation. The systems of Caesar, Caesar's swords, his coins, his gambling soldiers. We don't want to look at that truth in Eastertide. We've left that behind on Good Friday. We don't want to know the truth of our world anymore or of ourselves, let alone speaking the truth. We want to protect what we have. We don't want to look at what sin has done to us and to our world. We don't want to look. A few weeks ago, just before Holy Week, I had some looking of my own to do. My colleague and friend, Canon Angela Shepherd, who works for my bishop, Bishop Sutton, asked me to go to a conference with her in Minneapolis. The conference was for 3 days, right before Holy Week. I said yes, and the conference had an edgy name. In its 12th year, it's called the White Privilege Conference. That was the name. The conference is the brainchild of Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., who is director of diversity at the Bush School in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And the vision of the conference is to build a community committed to dismantling white privilege, white supremacy, and oppression every day, everywhere. Part of the mission of the conference is to empower and equip individuals to work for equity and justice through self and social transformation. And as soon as I got to the conference, it became clear that I was being called to look at the world and be transformed, to see powers and structures and injustices that I might not be seeing. Every person's view from this cross is a bit different. But what I saw and experienced last week made me do some intense praying and wondering of my own. It made me look closer. Our keynote speaker at the conference was a powerful witness. Her name is Michelle Alexander. Ms. Alexander, I believe Dr. Alexander, is a highly acclaimed civil rights lawyer, advocate, and scholar. She is an associate professor of law at Ohio State University. But before that, she was director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU in Oakland, California. While in Oakland, she interviewed thousands of criminals as part of a study about our prison system. She has now written a book called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Her speech received a standing ovation, and it helped me to look. It made me look. Look at a system that we all know well in Baltimore City, a system that leads to 4 out of 5 black men in certain zip codes, including 21217, to be incarcerated in their lifetime, a system in which the war on drugs has produced more convictions for drugs than convictions for any and all other reasons, a war on drugs that is waged almost exclusively, and she would say exclusively, in poor communities of color when drugs are everywhere and not just in our city. Alexander believes that this war on drugs is not about making our city streets safe, but has everything to do with racial politics that grew from a Southern political strategy to flip the South from blue state to red state. A system that has disenfranchised a whole generation of people of color and will disenfranchise more. Our prisons are built on federal money and big business. Maryland Death Row has moved to the huge complex in Western Maryland, where jobs are needed and many are employed, where the system pits blacks against whites. Other facts I learned and had to look at this conference for the first time are these, which some of you probably already know. Anyone convicted of a felony loses the right to vote for the rest of their lives, excluded from jury service for the rest of their lives, lifelong employment discrimination, housing discrimination is legal once you've been in prison, even in public housing. Public benefits are lost. The whole system is designed to send you back to prison. But what is worse is the shame and stigma of going to prison, of being a felon or a convicted criminal. Alexander said that this system is so entrenched in our cities, states, and federal governments that it will take a mass movement for education and human rights to upend it. Until we look at this system and acknowledge that it is creating a caste system, every bit as shaming and unjust as Jim Crow, we will continue to have violent cities and society. So I looked and I saw Baltimore City. I saw these very streets. I saw sin. And I saw myself and my people looking away. Asking, like that first criminal on the cross, I see us asking the Son of God to fix this, not me. But once I've looked and seen, then what? And I begin to think of the saints in our time that have turned over unjust systems for the most of us just seem too large to overthrow. I thought of Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu. I thought of Eleanor Roosevelt. I thought of Rosa Parks. Parker Palmer, the great spiritual writer, said that movements that transform us, our relations and our world, emerge from the lives of people who decide to care for their authentic selfhood. They decide to live divided no more. They decide no longer to act on the outside in a way that contradicts some truth about themselves that they hold deeply on the inside. They decide to claim authentic selfhood and act it out, and their decisions ripple out to transform the society in which they live, serving the selfhood of millions of others. Later in the Gospel of John, in this section about Jesus as the Good Shepherd, the Good Shepherd will bring us to one flock under one shepherd, divided no more. When she asked why she sat down in the front of the bus that day, Rosa Parks did not say she sat down to launch a movement. She sat down because she was tired. And not just that her feet were tired, but her soul was tired. Her heart was tired. Her whole being was tired of playing by a society with racist rules, tired of denying her soul's claim to selfhood. Where do people find the courage to live divided no more when they know they will be punished for it? Palmer points to Rosa Parks and our modern saints who transform the notion of punishment itself, like 1 Peter. They come to understand that no punishment anyone might inflict on them could possibly be worse than the punishment they inflict on themselves by conspiring in their own diminishment. When we allow unjust systems to rule our world, we are all conspiring in our own diminishment. In one of the workshops I attended at the conference, we told stories with each other. One woman talked about her fear of her teenage son, an African-American male living in a large city. She was afraid every time he went out at night. She was afraid of a traffic stop. She had told him again and again to keep his hands in sight when stopped, to not make any quick movements. She feared a wrong arrest, what might happen to him overnight in a holding cell. And I thought of my own son, Jack, about to graduate from college at that workshop. And I thought of his friend, Howard Grant, who was on his Little League team. Many of you remember that Howard died in a gang-related shooting a few years ago, just down the way from here. My son graduated from college on Monday. Howard never had that chance. So when I drove down I-85, when I saw those crosses on the hillside, I thought of our city this time, of looking away, of trying to look, and of trying to find Jesus as my good shepherd to show me where to follow, how to act. And as part of that workshop, I wrote a letter to my son, and here it is. Dear Jack, I was thinking of you today when I heard the story of a mother who feared for her son's life every night at the hands of the police. I want you to know how proud I am of you, and also to tell you how blessed you are in so many ways. One privilege that you have of no doing of your own is the privilege of color that you have in this world. This privilege is one that must be acknowledged and used for the good. When Howard Grant was killed on the streets of Baltimore, I realized how I didn't worry about you when you were arrested your freshman year in college in Athens, Georgia, in a fraternity rush event, which included underage drinking. I didn't worry what might happen to you in that Athens, Georgia holding cell or in the court system. Howard didn't have that chance. I remember Howard and you on that Little League baseball team, his glee when he caught the ball in the outfield, his aunt who cared for him good-naturedly needling the umpires for a strike or two. Somehow Howard wandered away from us. Somehow he returned to the city, and one night he was shot in a gang payback. This is not what God or Jesus, our good shepherd, would want our world to be. Today you graduate from college. Always remember to respect the dignity of every human being. Look for where this is not happening. Use your blessing for good. Challenge injustice. Always be looking. What is our good shepherd who laid down his life for us, asking each of us to see this Eastertide? Where and how are we called to look and to lay down our lives? Amen.